Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, I'm Steph.
I'm Alex.
And this is Not Today.
And we're live.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm just dandy.
Good.
You know?
A new bonus episode came out over on Patreon last week, so if you are interested in getting access to a bunch of bonus episodes, head over to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast just to get that plug right out of the way at the front. And for the sake of announcements, we are taking the week of Christmas off, so next week there will be no episode. Womp womp.
We're sorry, but we only take 1 week off.
That's true. You know? Every year we only take Christmas off, and here we are at Christmas time. So yeah, take the time to be with friends and family and loved ones and whatever, and we'll be doing the same.
And if you must, there's quite a backlog.
That's true. If you can't get enough of us, you can head over to our Patreon and get a bunch of extra content. So it's a win for everyone, and it would make a great Christmas present. Just keep that in mind. Anyway.
I don't disagree.
But anyway, I am very excited to jump into this week's episode because we're talking about something that has interested me for a long time. And also, our patrons wanted to hear about this, but this was the second place for our bonus episode. So we're talking about it over here.
It was almost the Patreon episode this week, but it fell short in the polls.
Well, last week. But yes, it was a very, very close poll. So for that reason, and because it's Christmas and I'm feeling giving, we'll talk about it over here and we'll get a back-to-back for our patrons, which is pretty cool. So yeah, why don't we jump in? We're talking about some near-death experiences.
Yeah, I'm in.
So I feel like I should preface this episode by saying that I am not a doctor, nor am I a scientist. I did, however, do a bunch of research, so I'm going to talk to you about it and I'm going to tell you what I found, but you know, just keep that in mind.
We're not experts. We're just people.
We don't claim to be, but we do like to talk about interesting things, and here we are. So, most of the information for this first part I got from an article on PubMed Central National Library of Medicine, written by Dr. Jeffrey Long, who is a recognized world expert on near-death experiences and established the nonprofit Near-Death Experience Research Foundation and a website for him, nderf.org. which is just the abbreviation, for people to share their near-death experiences.
This is insane. So this is what year, do you know?
That the article was written?
That he opened up the forum, because it just sounds like a Reddit page.
So the foundation and the website was launched in 1998. So it's been around for quite some time.
Wow, okay. So this is like one of the first Reddit pages.
I mean, I wouldn't call it a Reddit page. It's like a...
It's its own thing.
Research forum. It's like a place for people to post their stories and also take a survey, and they collect data from the website. I think it's like 80 survey questions or something like that for people to explain their near-death experiences. And I think there is, you know, a section of it that is a forum and people talking about their experiences, but it's more scientific than a Reddit.
Sure. No, I'm going to need to go check it out after this. Just want to know what they talk about.
Yeah, there's a lot of like videos of experts talking and the forum for people's stories and whatever. But point being, most of the research that I'm going to talk about in this beginning part, before we get into people's actual experiences, was from an article written by Dr. Jeffrey Long, who established this website and forum and foundation. All the words. A near-death experience, or an NDE, is a profound personal experience associated with death or impending death, which researchers describe as having similar characteristics. When positive, which the great majority are, such experiences may encompass a variety of sensations, including detachment from the body, feelings of levitation, total serenity, security, warmth, joy, the experience of absolute dissolution, review of major life events, the presence of a light, and seeing dead relatives. When negative, such experiences may include sensations of anguish, distress, a void, devastation, and seeing hellish imagery. Near-death experiences are reported by about 17% of those who nearly die. NDEs have been reported by children, adults, scientists, physicians, priests, ministers, religious people, atheists, and people from countries throughout the world. So pretty much it doesn't matter who you are, you can have one of these experiences. And somewhat surprisingly, religious people don't seem to be the more inclined toward NDEs, which you might expect.
Interesting. Okay.
Near-death experiences occur at a time when the person is so physically compromised that they are typically unconscious, comatose, or clinically dead. Considering NDEs from both a medical perspective and logically, it should not be possible for unconscious people to often report highly lucid experiences that are clear and logically structured. Most NDEs report supernormal consciousness at the time of their NDE. Near-death experiences have been reported across time and cultures, according to scientificamerican.com, an astounding 5 to 10% of the general population is estimated to have memories of an NDE, including somewhere between 10 and 23% of cardiac arrest survivors. Prior studies found that 10 to 20 seconds following cardiac arrest, electroencephalogram measurements generally find no significant measurable brain cortical electrical activity. Oh my God, that was so many words. Basically, there's no activity going on in your brain, but you're having these experiences. A prolonged, detailed, lucid experience following cardiac arrest should not be possible, yet this is reported in many NDEs. This is especially notable given the prolonged period of amnesia that typically precedes and follows recovery from cardiac arrest. So basically, you don't have brain function happening, so there should be no reason why you're having a like very real lucid experience for many people.
Interesting. Okay. So scientifically, it's not supposed to happen.
Correct. Yeah.
And then what's the part of amnesia like people... I mean, they remember their experience or they forget their, like, quote unquote, regular life. Like, what kind of amnesia are they having?
So from what I'm gathering, it's like when you have like a cardiac event or something like this, if you don't have oxygen going to your brain, that typically will result in amnesia for patients. So like they won't remember certain things, like either the day or other periods of their life, like... You can lose memories from like lack of oxygen to your brain.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So it's just either they're losing memories about the actual event or chunks of their life. I guess I was confused because you were saying like, oh, they remember these experiences but also have amnesia. So I didn't know if it was something that kind of comes together later, like they kind of forget their near-death experience and then remember it days later.
No, so I think it's like typically a person who would experience this kind of event should have amnesia, but they don't, and they have this experience instead.
Oh, wow, that's so interesting.
Yeah.
Does anyone have theories about why that you came across?
Why that happens? No, it's like medically, it doesn't make sense.
Okay, so just nobody even has a theory.
I guess maybe someone has a theory, but not one that I came across. From what I did see, all the experts that were talking about it and the doctors that were talking about it were like, this shouldn't happen. This doesn't make sense.
It's funny.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
A common characteristic of near-death experiences is an out-of-body experience, or OBE. An out-of-body experience is the apparent separation of consciousness from the body. About 45% of near-death experiences report OBEs, which involve them seeing and often hearing ongoing earthly events from a perspective that is apart and usually above their physical bodies. Following cardiac arrest, NDEers may see and later accurately describe their own resuscitation.
Whoa.
And this has been studied. Dr. Michael Sabam and Dr. Penny Sartori separately investigated groups of patients who had cardiac arrests with NDEs that included out-of-body experiences and compared them with a control group of patients who experienced cardiac crises but did not have an NDE. Both groups of patients were asked to describe their own resuscitation as best as they could, and Sabam found that the group of NDE patients were much more accurate than the control group in describing their own resuscitations. And Dr. Sartori found that the people who experienced NDEs were very accurate in describing their own resuscitations, while the control group was very inaccurate.
Wow. Okay.
Some studies were done on people who were clinically comatose as well, not just during resuscitations, or people who could accurately describe events happening far from their bodies at the time of this experience happening, way beyond any possible physical sensory awareness.
Wait, so, like, how far away?
I don't know how far it actually could reach, but it's like, oh, I'm being resuscitated in this room, and, like, in the lobby of the hospital, my brother is, like, pacing back and forth and making phone calls and is, like, upset and scared
kind of thing. Whoa, like, hundreds of feet away.
Yeah, potentially.
I mean, even in the next room would be crazy.
Yeah, so like people can accurately describe events that were happening at the time of their NDE in places that their body was not even present.
That's insane. But like that was part of the study that this professor did?
Not the study that I just described, but there has been other research that's been done. I don't have like a specific example right now, but this is like the kind of work that's being done around NDEs, which is really cool.
That's insane. Yeah, because the naysayer in me is like, okay, what kind of, like, what actual details did they gather?
Sure.
Away from themselves? But I mean, if it proves out even for a small percentage of people to accurately describe events that were happening when they were, number one, like, dead, and number two, not even in the room it was happening, I mean, that's remarkable.
I know. Yeah, the high percentage of accurate out-of-body observations during near-death experiences does not seem explainable by any possible physical brain function as it is currently known. People may also undergo a life review and morally evaluate the choices they have made, including by experiencing the joy or pain their actions have caused others. Sam Parnia, director of critical care and resuscitation research at the NYU Langone Medical Center, said, "What's intriguing is that when people die, they don't evaluate themselves based on their own standards of morals. They evaluate themselves based on the universal standard." An example of that would be, and this is a quote from the forum that we talked about at the beginning, quote, "I went into a dark place with nothing around me, but I wasn't scared. I was really peaceful there. I then began to see my whole life unfolding before me like a film projected on a screen, from babyhood to adult life. It was so real. I was looking at myself, but better than a 3D movie, as I was also capable of sensing the feelings of the persons I had interacted with throughout the years. I could feel the good and bad emotions I made them go through." Many NDEs may describe encounters with deceased loved ones. In dreams or hallucinations, when familiar people are present, they are much more likely to be living and from recent memory. However, in near-death experiences, familiar people encountered are almost always deceased.
Interesting.
So it's like I died and went to this other place and my grandma was there waiting for me and she said something to me and like, you know, whatever. There's a lot of experiences like that.
I mean, that just gives me chills.
I know. Very young children have also been studied, and their experiences are the same as older children and adults, which is cool because at an early age, children are a lot less likely to have established religious beliefs, cultural understandings about death, or even an awareness of what death is. And people who report NDEs also typically say they experienced a heightened awareness. Their consciousness became heightened and more vivid, or they were more aware. Blind people have also been studied, and many reported having sight during an NDE or OBE, even those who were blind since birth.
That's insane. That detail is crazy.
It's so cool. Although most people describe their NDE in glowing terms, a minority recount visits to hell-like regions, encounters with demonic beings, or terrifying voids. And we do have a story like that that we're going to talk about. In a 2019 study, neuroscientist Charlotte Marshall and her colleagues found that among 123 people who reported an NDE, 14% classified it as negative. A proportion, Marshall says, she is sure is an understatement because of how disturbing these memories can be. So multiple lines of evidence point to the conclusion that near-death experiences are medically inexplicable and cannot be explained by known physical brain function. But in a survey taken of 1,122 NDEers, more than 1,000 of them believed that their experiences were without a doubt real.
I mean, this to me seems like what religion was born out of.
Yeah, it is very tied to religion for a lot of people. But this, like I said earlier, it happens to people who are atheist or who do not have a religious affiliation or like a belief in heaven and hell, or, you know, children and adults and, you know, scientists and priests, and everyone has them. I mean, not everyone, but all different types of people have them. So it's not necessarily linked to religion.
Right. But, you know, I imagine 3,000 years ago, if you had one of these experiences, you'd be like, oh, I'm a prophet and I spoke to God.
Sure. Yeah, I could totally see that.
Or I went to hell and came back.
Right.
To me, the really interesting part about the hellish experiences would be any children that experience them.
Oh.
Because they probably haven't been told stories about like, oh, this is what hell is. They just kind of came up with it out of nowhere independently, you know?
Yeah, I haven't come across any information about children having the like hellish experiences, but that would be really interesting to look into and to hear about because, yeah, you're right. It's like, what would that be like for someone who doesn't have any knowledge of what that could be or would be according to religion? But then again, on the flip side, they don't have any knowledge of like heaven, if you want to call it that, or whatever either. So it's like their experiences are just completely pure as it is. I don't know. It would be interesting to hear about that.
Yeah. I mean, it's true that way too. I guess I was just trying to think about a way to control this because for people who have been exposed to that type of imagery or you've kind of been exposed to, you know, what quote unquote heaven or hell should be, like maybe it seeps into these experiences. Whereas like children would not have that necessarily.
Yeah. It's an interesting thought. I don't know though. But I'm very interested in this topic. I think it's so cool. And I have three stories of people who experienced these NDEs, and we can talk about like their experience leading up to when they were clinically dead and then their NDE and, you know, a little bit afterward. So
yeah, I'm very excited.
Let's get into those. Okay. So our first story takes place in Monmouth County, New Jersey in June of 2002. Growing up there, Chuck Murata said he spent his summers having wonderful days at the beach, and the winters were very cold. There was a lot of deep snow and a lot of snowmen. Chuck bought his first motorcycle when he had just turned 17. It was a red and white Daytona 500. He rode it in the rain, in the snow, in hurricanes. He loved this bike.
Wait, he rode it in hurricanes?
According to Chuck, yes.
You're wild man, Chuck.
Yeah. Over the years, Chuck owned multiple other bikes and became a very experienced rider. Chuck's sister Patty said he had always been into car and motorcycle racing. Speed was his thing. Chuck and Patty came from a large family of 8 children. Patty was the 8th child and Chuck was number 7. So they were always together and Chuck took care of his baby sister. In 2001, Chuck bought his dream bike, a Harley-Davidson Deuce, and at first, everything was great. That was until a year later, on June 4th, 2002. At the time, Chuck was 47 years old and had decided to take his bike on a ride in the country. He was traveling eastbound on a road called Route 537. It's a 2-lane, 55-mile-per-hour road lined with horse farms and orchards. So he was mostly just enjoying the scenery. What?
I'm wincing because I know where this is going.
Oh, I see. Yeah, it's a motorcycle, so it's going to be bad.
I just, whenever I'm on this type of road where it's 2-lane highway, 55, and I see a semi, I shit my pants every time.
Yeah.
Because it's like, you're too close to getting absolutely obliterated by the other car. It's different from any other kind of collision because you're just multiplying the impact by two.
For a motorcycle, you mean?
Well, just for anything.
Oh, for going like in a semi collision?
No, because you have one car that's coming at you at 55 as you're going into it.
Yes. Yeah. At 55. That would be really terrible. So,
well, if you're driving, don't think about that.
Hey, think happy thoughts.
You know what I mean? But this is what goes through my head.
Sure.
On a two-lane highway.
Yeah. Well, my first thought was that this is a motorcycle, and that typically leads to really awful crashes. So, anyway.
Scenery was worth it, I bet, though.
I don't think so.
No?
I don't think so.
Right.
After a while, Chuck was coming up to an area in the road that had a slight S-curve, and in his mind, he was anticipating leaning with the curve and riding along as normal. However, up ahead, there was an F-450 crew cab truck that was waiting in a driveway about to pull out onto the highway. Chuck could see the driver do a quick glance over his shoulder in his direction, but it was clear in that moment that this truck driver was going to pull out onto the road. The driver hadn't seen Chuck and had pulled his truck directly into Chuck's path. Chuck was traveling at 50 miles per hour, and there was no way he was going to avoid running into the side of this truck. So in the split second he had to think, Chuck decided that rather than slam his 650-pound motorcycle into this 8,500-pound truck, he would throw himself off of his bike, kick it away from him, and take his chances. He figured worst-case scenario, he would get some road rash from sliding on the pavement. So Chuck pushed the bike out from underneath him and slid down the road on his back. He was sliding feet first, right toward the front end of this truck. He had his hands down on the pavement trying to slow himself down, but it was not working. He was moving too fast. He slid right up into the front end of the truck, right in front of the front wheel. He immediately put his hands up on the fender to try to keep himself from sliding under the truck, but the driver rolled the truck on top of Chuck's chest and then stopped.
Oh my God.
This truck weighed over 4 tons.
Yeah.
So for a moment, as Chuck lay there, he looked up at the wheel and thought to himself, "Isn't it incredible that this truck is parked on top of me?" Immediately following that, he thought, "This isn't going to be good." So he's still awake and lucid as this truck wheel is parked on top of him.
Don't describe anymore.
Oh,
this is so beyond like visceral.
It's going to get more visceral. So I guess give a little trigger warning because the description of what comes next is not great. Just keep that in mind.
Oh, no.
Okay. So the man driving the truck scrambled out and ran to where Chuck was laying on the ground. And he was in shock. He began profusely apologizing, insisting he had not seen Chuck. "He's so sorry he didn't see you, blah, blah, blah." And Chuck, who had the wheel of this man's truck on his chest still and was somehow still alive and conscious, looked up at him and said, "Well, do you see me now?" Imagine.
Oh my God. That's what you say.
That's what he said.
That's so morbidly hilarious.
I know. Yeah. So the man said, "Yes, I'm sorry. I'm sorry." And Chuck asked him if he could get his truck off of him. So the man scurried back to his truck. And Chuck said his body was hypersensitive. He could feel everything. Chuck said when the driver opened the door, he felt the door swinging on its hinges. He felt the truck being put into gear. And as it started to move, Chuck said he felt everything breaking in his chest. It was as if someone was taking a package of saltine crackers in the wrapper and was stepping on them, and they crumpled for what seemed like forever.
Oh my God.
Chuck's entire rib cage snapped. 2 of the broken bones pierced his right lung, which caused it to collapse. He had a ruptured spleen and a broken pelvis.
How did that not already happen?
I don't know. But it was when the driver backed off of him is when everything cracked.
Uh-huh.
Yep. So Chuck looked down at his feet, and he saw that his feet and legs were fine, and his arms weren't broken either. But once he attempted to take his first breath after the truck was off of his body, he could not get any air. He attempted to inhale, and nothing happened.
Yeah, well, no shit, dude.
Right.
It's like you just got run over by a
truck.
Truck.
Yeah. He tried again to take a breath, but he couldn't get any air.
Ugh.
Chuck's punctured right lung was leaking air into his chest cavity. The escaped air was pressing on his left lung and causing that one to collapse under pressure as well. So he had no lung function. Just no air, nothing. Chuck knew this was really bad, and he had no idea what was going to happen, but he managed to roll up onto his left side and curled up into a fetal position as he tried his best to calm himself down. But at the same time, he knew that he was going to die, and Chuck's heart stopped due to asphyxiation from lung failure. Chuck described his next moments as a very warm and comfortable feeling. According to him, it was as if all of his worldly worries dissipated and nothing was important anymore. He said, quote, "It felt like I slid into this jacuzzi that was just perfect temperature, and everything felt just as wonderful as it could feel to the physical body." Chuck said he believed at that moment that he was dead. All of a sudden, Chuck looked up and he saw his mother and his grandmother standing about 30 to 50 feet in front of him, and they looked absolutely gorgeous. They looked like they were around 30 to 35 years old. They were dressed in all black and had pearl necklaces on, and they looked the best that he could have imagined they would have looked in their lives. He said he couldn't believe it. Everything around them looked so bright, not like looking into the sun bright, but he said it was almost as if there was a beautiful blue sky, clear backdrop. His mother and his grandmother standing there in that light was just incredible. It had been a lot of years since he had been in their presence. So meanwhile, when paramedics arrived on the scene, they found Chuck with severe chest trauma and no pulse. They pierced his chest with a draining tube to release the pressure around his lungs, but it was really a race against time. One of the paramedics put an IV into Chuck's arm, and another inserted a breathing tube into his airway and began hooking him up to a ventilator. Meanwhile, Chuck felt like he knew he had died, but he was going home, and he was ecstatic. He said he began taking giant steps toward them and began running because he couldn't wait to embrace them. But looking at his grandmother, Chuck knew that they weren't going to let him stay. His mother said, "You can't stay. You have to go back. We're not ready for you."
Whoa. This happens to so many people though, right?
Yeah.
"We're not ready for you" is like actually the phrase I feel like I've heard from other experiences like this.
Yeah, I have as well.
"We're not ready for you." That's insane. Saying that it's always the same. Uh-huh. Or it's like mostly the same.
Yeah, for so many people. That's why these NDEs are so interesting, is because so many people have the exact same experience. I mean, different for each other, you know, like he's experiencing his mother and his grandmother.
Right.
So, but yeah, very similar.
And then he knew what she was going to say before she said it.
Yeah, looking at her face, looking at his grandmother's face, he said he knew she wasn't going to let him stay. And then his mother said, "We're not ready for you."
This is nuts, dude.
I know. So Chuck said he got mad, like he always did when he was a child. He remembers stomping his foot and turned around. And as he took one step back toward wherever he was coming from, he then heard this woman's voice saying, "We have a pulse." He then heard her say, "You gotta stay with us." And once again, Chuck got angry because he didn't want to hear that. But he also felt like he had nowhere else to go. So in his mind, he thought, "Shut up and do whatever you gotta do, because I can't go where I want to go." Chuck was officially breathing again, but he was still in critical condition. The paramedics loaded him into the ambulance and rushed him to Jersey Shore Hospital. Alex is fist bumping. That is, yeah, that's the vibe. Snooki was his doctor.
Oh my God.
Chuck's chest.
I'm sorry. I just can't believe that the hospital's named that.
Well, it is Jersey Shore. So what else are you going to call it?
I don't know, man.
Chuck's chest looked like a half-filled water balloon or a bowl of jello, is what he described. He said it was like shaking and shimmering every time somebody moved him, which I can't fully picture, but...
Shaking and shimmering.
That was his words. I don't know.
Let's move on from that.
Okay. He had a broken pelvic bone, two fractured discs, broken rib cage, a separated sternum, a ruptured spleen, half of the palm of his hand was gone from trying to slow himself down as he slid down the road, and soon after he reached the hospital, his lungs collapsed once again. Chuck's sister Patty got a call from the hospital basically telling her Chuck had been in an accident and it was motorcycle versus truck. So immediately she knew that it was going to be bad, and she rushed to the hospital. By the time she had arrived, Chuck had been put on life support and was put into an induced coma. Patty was told by doctors that the first 72 hours would tell the story, but all she could do then was wait. She listened to the clock as each minute ticked by, but all she wanted was the doctor to come in and tell her that Chuck was going to be okay. Chuck was in a coma and on life support for 6 weeks before he woke up. He remembers waking up in a hospital room with all kinds of things hooked up to him, a tube in his throat, and he remembered a nurse named Donna asked him, "Do you remember what happened?" Chuck tried to say motorcycle and truck. And after that, she said, "You're going to be okay." Less than 48 hours later, Chuck was taken off of the ventilator, and the next day, when Patty came to see Chuck at the hospital, he had walked and met her at the elevator.
Excuse me, what?
So after being in a coma for 6 weeks, 48 hours later, he is walking and meeting his sister at the elevator.
How?
I don't know. He just...
Did they... I mean, you just read his rap sheet. I mean, this is... Did they do surgery to fix it all? Or
they must have.
Right. But he just... he walked within 48 hours. I mean, it's insane. I guess technically... Well, you said he broke his pelvis.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that just got fixed in 6 weeks.
Yeah. I mean, he was laying there unmoving for 6 weeks recovering. So I don't know.
This is just insane to me.
I just got the facts.
I know. I'm trying to wrap my head around it. You gotta give me a minute here.
Sure.
Because I was going to say, well, I guess nothing technically was wrong with his legs.
Nope.
Just his chest. But yep. I mean, the fact that he can walk is, I can't believe it.
Yeah, neither could Patty. She was not expecting him to meet her at the elevator, but he did. And there were a lot of happy tears that day. He spent the next 18 months recovering at home. And Chuck, who is a former railroad worker, is now retired because of the effects of his injuries. He said his experience changed his life for the better, and he has done his best to live his life to the fullest. He said he's trying out new things, such as skydiving. He still loves to ride his motorcycle, the same 2001 Harley-Davidson Deuce he laid down back in 2002. And he managed to fulfill a good portion of his bucket list. He bought a nice sports car and got to race it on a road course, so... He is living it up. He said, quote, "I have no more fear of death. It's one of the things we have to face, and for me, the crossing over is a beautiful experience. You might not want to, but everybody is going to have to do it sooner or later. I only hope their experience is as good as mine was."
That's insane.
And that's Chuck's story.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know where to start.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I guess this kind of does sound like maybe a stereotypical story like this, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I don't think there was anything that crazy, except that it was. Do you get what I'm trying to say?
It's
like, if you were to tell me, like, the main... If you were to give me a three-sentence summary of this, I'd be like, yeah, that seems like a common trope. Mm-hmm. But just the details of this are crazy. Like, he just got backed over with a truck, and then he hears the EMT reviving him.
Mm-hmm. And says, "We have a pulse," right as he takes a step back.
Yeah.
Because his mom was like, "You can't stay."
Yeah, you can't stay. And then he like knew what she was going to say.
Yeah.
Yeah. The details of this story are just, I'm still trying to wrap my head around it.
Yeah, that's kind of how I feel about this whole topic. But I have two more stories and two more people's experiences. So why don't we jump into those?
Let's do it.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
This next one is an example of someone who had a negative near-death experience, which I hadn't found many of, but I did find this one. So,
yeah, I mean, it's interesting that these are the minority.
I know. I'm kind of glad. You know?
Well, me too, but yeah. You know, I guess it's just not what I would have thought.
Who knows? I have no idea how any of this works. I am merely the messenger, so.
Well, if you want to pontificate and say things are true, we can do that too.
Sure. Everything I say is true and real. Don't fact check anything.
It's real if you don't fact check it.
Okay. So Matthew, lived in West Bloomfield, Massachusetts in September of 1992. 28-year-old Matthew had been married for 4 years, and he and his wife Nancy met in high school band. They were the cool people in band, according to them, and they started dating their senior year of high school. He had spent years of his life working toward the goal of having the biggest house he could on the water. He said at the time he was very materialistic and wanted to make as much money as possible to live the American dream. Matthew and his brother John worked together on the family business selling outdoor equipment. He really enjoyed working with his brother. They had a good time together, and he was able to learn from him and said that his brother was very smart. Matthew wanted to work hard to impress his dad and his brother, but also to take care of his family. John and Matthew lived within 5 houses of each other, so they were constantly together. They could literally hear each other as they got up and left for work every day. Matthew and John traveled together to Atlanta on business, and they arrived at the hotel and decided they should go out for some dinner to plan for the convention that they were there for. And after dinner, they waited outside the restaurant for a taxi. Matthew remembers having his hand shoved in his pockets of his black leather jacket, and he had cowboy boots on, and they were standing out there chatting as they waited. Next thing they knew, they heard squealing as a car came around the side of the building, and then the loud pops of gunfire as a man shot an automatic 9mm Uzi out the window of the car all over the side of this building. Matthew felt an excruciating pain. It was as if someone took a hot poker or a very long needle and jabbed it straight through his skull. He had been shot in the head during this random drive-by shooting. He immediately went down. His hands never even came out of his pockets. He was just laying there. John started screaming for someone to call 911. "My brother's dying. He's been shot." Matthew had a bullet lodged in the right side of his brain. Coming from the backside of his head, John started to see a pool of blood forming on the pavement. It was as if black ink had poured over Matthew's eyes. Everything was gone. And that was when Matthew died. He was dead instantly when the gunshot hit his head. And according to him, he was transferred from one dimension to another in a split second. John said once the emergency people came, it was chaos. There were so many people running around. They loaded Matthew up into an ambulance, and off they went to the hospital. Matthew said, quote, "There is a real hell. There is a cell in hell that I was thrust into. I'm shackled at the wrists, left wrist, right wrist. I'm shackled at my ankles, and I'm outstretched over this deep abyss." He described it as an endless pit, but he could see the glowing embers and gray smoke that billowed up from lava that would rise to the ceiling. Matthew had no clothes on, and he could feel the heat rising from this pit, and he could hear screams, some guttural sounding, some low, and some very high. He couldn't understand any of them, but he could hear the torment. He was terrified and could feel that where he was pure evil. He said time was non-existent. It was an eternal experience that was happening to him, and it was only evil. He could also tell that there was no way out. Meanwhile, Matthew was being rushed into the ER. Paramedics were unable to revive Matthew with CPR. John was left to wait and make the hardest phone call he had ever had to make to his parents. All he could handle saying was, "Matt's been shot," before hanging up the phone. He then called Nancy and told her the same thing and then hung up. Back in Matthew's other dimension, he had no memories of who he was or who Nancy was, but he fully understood what eternity meant, which, I mean, I can't fully grasp, but this is what he experienced. And he felt like he was being tortured. He felt a lot of terror and hopelessness in that state, and he knew that there was no way out. He couldn't move to either side or up and down. He said it felt like he was being kept and confined. At no point did he ask himself why. He was just flooded with a sense of evil and fear. But then, at that moment, in the upper right corner, he saw this protrusion coming from the outside in, kind of like if you're pushing your finger through a thick plastic bag. It was pushing into this realm that he was in, and eventually it penetrated this realm. Back at the hospital, Matthew had been dead for about 4 minutes, and ER doctors were working to revive him. They had tried electrical shocks, which had failed, to start his heart, and the odds of his survival were almost zero. Massive shock and blood loss had shut down all of his organs, and brain death had begun. Meanwhile, Matthew saw that what had come through was a finger, And then it was the entirety of a man's hand. The size was massive. It was like the hand of a giant that was descending toward him. He could see the cracks and wrinkles on this hand very vividly. Something inside of Matthew knew that this hand was a good thing, like it was a rescue that was happening. It sounded like there was thunder and lightning, and he said he realized that this hand was translucent. He could see right through it. He could see the knuckle joints, the bones, everything. And it looked like it was pumping what he described as lifeblood. There was a brilliant white light, and then he heard the sound of celebration and a stringed orchestra and chorus. The moment the hand came down, it grabbed Michael by the waist, and then the shackles around him disappeared. A brilliant white light filled the cavern, and it started to pull him out of this cell. He heard a male voice say, "It's not your time."
Whoa.
And in that moment, all of his fear vanished. About 5 minutes after losing his pulse, doctors were finally able to restart Matthew's heart with CPR. But he had massive brain damage, and at that point, they did not expect him to survive the night. When John was finally able to see Matthew, he couldn't believe how many things he had hooked up to him. His face was swollen, and one eye was so big it looked like it was coming out of his head. Matthew's wife, Nancy, flew to Atlanta and arrived at the hospital only a few hours later. She said the only way she was able to tell that it was her husband was by his wedding ring, and she couldn't believe that this was who she was looking at. She said she couldn't even feel a connection to him. It felt as if he was gone. He was in a deep coma at that point and was not expected to live. Doctors asked Nancy to sign a consent for Matthew's organs to be harvested and to unplug him, basically. He was 28 years old at the time. He was young and healthy, and now he could die any minute. But Nancy refused to terminate Matthew's life support. She stayed with him at his bedside for 27 days. As she sat there, she was holding his hand, and when they first started dating, when they held hands, they would play thumb wars, or like, the thumb game, where you go 1, 2, 3, and, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Okay.
I know what you're talking
about. I just want to make sure I'm illustrating it correctly. Thumb wars. Anyway, she started to do that, the 1, 2, and then before she went back to do 3, his thumb went on top of hers. And she said he cheated because he went before 3, which was something that he would always do. So she could not believe it, and she immediately screamed, "He's in there." When Matthew woke up, he was in a hospital bed surrounded by get well cards. He had a hole in his neck from the tube and had no idea where he was or the memory of what happened. When John finally saw Matthew, all he could do was look at him. Matthew gave him a thumbs up and John gave one back, and they both started crying. But he had made it. The two brothers said they only got closer after that incident, as well as Matthew and Nancy. And Matthew spent 2 years in rehab and made a significant recovery. His left side is still partially paralyzed, and the bullet remains lodged in his brain because taking it out could kill him. But he said since that experience, he has no fears of death anymore, and he said he knows where he's going, and he's not going to the bad side. He does think it's cool that he's seen both sides, the good and the evil. So I guess for him, it does seem kind of like a religious thing. But I mean, that was his experience, was that he was in the bad side and got taken out to the good side. So I don't know.
By the translucent hand.
Yeah. Pumping the lifeblood. I have no idea what that actually means, but it seemed very real to him.
Yeah. I mean, it seems so similar to a dream state.
Kinda. I mean, that one in particular does kind of seem like a dream state, but the next one we're going to talk about does not.
I wonder if they've, how many different classifications that they've made for these types of experiences, because some of them do seem like this, where it's supernatural almost and dreamlike.
Right.
And then other ones, it's like the experience you're having is like imposed, or like transposed is maybe the word I'm looking for, on top of the real world where you were.
Yeah, that's kind of like the next one we're going to talk about. I mean, so Chuck and Matthew both had experiences that were like kind of dreamlike. You know, Chuck saw his mother and his grandmother standing in this like beautiful place and whatever. And then Matthew had this really awful, like hellish experience, and a giant hand came and saved him. But the next one is an example of an out-of-body experience where the person who experiences death is then kind of just like floating above the area that their body is, and they can like see what's going on around them.
Whoa.
So okay. It's really interesting. There's a lot of different types of these near-death experiences. Not all of them include an out-of-body experience, but those ones are the coolest to me.
Yeah. So you mentioned in the beginning of the story that he was living in kind of a materialistic way, just trying to get like the big house.
Yeah.
Do you think that, did that kind of come up for him in his, like, I mean, after this happened? Like, I'm trying to think of, you know, the people who have this quote unquote bad experience. Is it because they're kind of living immorally or out of line with their values in some way?
I could never say for sure or even speculate that that's the case. I mean, this man, I'm just telling you his story the way he explained it, like the way he was giving the interview. So I feel like for him, it was more of a religious thing. And so in order to like rationalize the place that he went, he was like, well, I was living very materialistically and, you know, I wasn't the best kind of person I could have been. And so it seems like it was just like a rationalization of why that happened to him. And for him, if that's the answer for him, then great. I'm not saying that that's right or wrong. I'm just telling you the story the way he told it. So I'm not saying that that's like the reason that happened, but it seems that like that's the reason he feels it happened.
Right. Okay. So that, I guess that was my question, was did he attribute that to the way he was living before?
It seems like it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's super interesting.
Yeah. But it seems like having a negative near-death experience is like less common in the community of people who have near-death experiences. So I don't know. I mean, it's hard to rationalize or explain any kind of near-death experience because they're so unbelievable. But also, if you go back to like the medical side of it, which again, I don't know much about, but like I can kind of understand that like when you are clinically dead and there's no oxygen or blood pumping to your brain or, you know, whatever, and there's no activity going on in your brain, there is no reason why someone should be having an experience like this where they're lucid and can remember such vivid details.
Right.
I don't know. This whole episode is kind of just like a shoulder shrug to me. It's just kind of like a, you know, like.
To me, it's like just eyes wide open in the back of your seat. Just like, what?
Yeah. I kind of feel similarly about this episode as I did to the reincarnation one we talked about, like the children experiencing past lives.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
So interesting. I mean, it kind of falls in the same place for me. So I don't know. But we have one last story. Do you want to get into it?
Yeah, I mean, I just had one more thought.
Sure.
Like for this experience, you could interpret it like the pit that's bottomless mm-hmm. and kind of has like lava coming up from it as the way he was living. Like if you are doing everything for materialistic gain, it's just empty. You know, it never ends. And it's just kind of interesting the symbolism you could gather from it.
Yeah.
You know, after the fact.
Yeah, which is why so many people who do have near-death experiences like do look at it kind of religiously. I don't know. I certainly don't know how I feel about that, you know? Like,
yeah, well, I mean, I feel like if you have the experience where you fully understand what eternity means, you might become religious.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that that would change a person. I don't know if he was religious beforehand or not. I think he probably was, just based off of how he was talking about it, but yeah, it definitely is interesting, and you could pick apart that story and like try to piece together the symbolism. I think you could pretty easily. Like it's very interesting.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I mean it seems like, you know, the symbolism is kind of straightforward.
Yeah.
But yeah, it just would be hilarious though if he had this type of experience and then went and started a cult or something, you know.
Sure. Yeah. I could see that happening. Not necessarily for Matthew. I'm sure he's a lovely person, but
yeah, nothing about Matthew, but
that would yeah. be funny.
Let's get into the next one.
Okay. So our last story is of Sandy, who lived in Kirkland, Washington in July of 2005. Sandy was a single mother and had been for about 11 years at the time. Her kids were 12 and almost 15, and to her, they were everything. They were the light of her life, and they came first. Life was hard for Sandy to make ends meet, but the kids played a lot of sports, and Sandy was the soccer mom type, and her family definitely kept busy. Despite any struggle Sandy had, she was happy and felt like she was in a really good place. She was not focused on dating or getting married anytime soon. She was just having a good time. And Sandy's neighbor invited her on a rafting trip with 25 other women. And she was very excited to be going on this trip. It was one of the first things that she had done for herself in a very long time. So the boat trip began in the Rogue River Rapids in Oregon. And when they got there, they met their guides. One of the guides was a man named Keith, and she could tell that he was a really nice guy. He helped the women fit their life jackets and their helmets, explained everything to them, normal guide duties. Keith was also having a great day. What?
What did you? Oh, okay. I think I just understood that.
Normal guide duties, not guy duties?
Yeah, no, I thought you said guy duties.
Just like, normal guy duties, you know. Explaining things to women.
I was like, okay. We're not going to read into it.
No, guide. He was the guide for the trip.
Sure.
Okay.
But he was also a man explaining things.
All right.
To
well,
women, you know.
Anyway, Keith was having a great day as well. He loved having his group for the day be a bunch of ladies who were enjoying each other's company. They were just a great group with really good energy.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Target, Nike, and Instacart. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. It's easy to use, and you can get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten, Rakuten.com.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
The group traveled downstream aboard four rafts and two kayaks. Keith was at the very end of the line of rafts watching over everyone, and Sandy was one of the people who was in a kayak, and she was just ahead of Keith. She was about a football field in front of him, and that was a little bit farther than he usually wanted people to be, but he was keeping a close eye on her. Her kayak was a little farther to the left in the water than where the guides typically would want the kayaks to be as they go over what's known as the John's Rapid. It's a high level 2 rapid, and when you're in a raft, it's fun and a little bit of a bumpy ride, but overall, not too bad. But when you're in a kayak, that level of rapid is much more challenging. As she got closer to the rapids, she was paddling as hard as she could to try to stay behind the raft, but the current started pulling her kayak to the left even more toward the rocks. Having rafted before, she knew the last thing she wanted to do was go into those rocks, and she was getting very scared, knowing that she had seen a lot of other glacial rocks in that area with caves underneath and places where you could get trapped. The closer she got to the rocks, the stronger the current got. The white water got stronger as it crashed into the rocks, and Sandy fell to the left and crashed right out of the kayak and was slammed into a boulder. The water pulled her so fast, and only seconds after falling into the water, the kayak hit her hard right in the head. Sandy was pinned, wrapped against a rock as the current of the river pushed her down. She tried using her legs to push off of the rock, but as soon as she would make a little headway, she would get stuck again. The white water was swirling around her head. She could hear the loud swooshing as the water raced past her. As she was pushing, she could feel herself getting physically weaker, since the water strength was incredible. Soon enough, she was pulled further down into the water around the rocks below. Her body was fully submerged, and she was holding her breath. Keith was 80 yards upstream of Sandy, so he yelled to the other women in the raft to grab their paddles. Keith had no idea how he was going to get her out. As Sandy was pulled further under the water, she was getting weaker and weaker, and it was hard to hold her breath. It was extremely dark down there, and it was getting hopeless. Keith occasionally could see Sandy's head, her body, her arms and legs, as she tried desperately to fight the rapids, but it was stronger than she was. Sandy then became trapped under a boulder, about 5 inches underwater. And from there, Sandy could see Keith's raft approaching from under the water. Like, she could see the boat, but she couldn't get up. When she saw that, there was a combination of relief and more panic. And by that point, she had been holding her breath for nearly a minute. Without really thinking about it, she screamed, "Help me." But the sound that came out of her didn't even sound like her. It was very high-pitched and panicky. As soon as she screamed it, she felt water gush into her throat. By the time she had been down there for a minute and a half, she was starting to lose consciousness from the lack of oxygen to her brain. She started seeing what she described as a slideshow of the same image. It was a sepia-toned image of her kids from the chest up, and the image kept disappearing and reappearing, and it was of her sons when they were older, like in their 20s. And meanwhile, her kids are currently 12 and 14.
Wow.
She was praying hard to not lose her kids. She couldn't explain how sad she was that she was about to die and lose them. Keith was still desperately trying to find a way to reach Sandy under the rapids. It was awful because she was only within a few feet of him, and he could see her beneath the rapids, but there wasn't a way for him to get to her. Before he had enough time to figure out what to do, he realized Sandy was no longer stuck on the boulder. The current had taken her somewhere down underneath the rocks. So Sandy had gotten lodged in a glacial cave 5 feet underwater. For Sandy, everything went black. And it occurred to her that she was dying. Everything went incredibly quiet. She said if she looked down, she wasn't sure if she would see her body or not. She said even in this state, it was her. She had her personality, but she got pulled into this black, kind of circular tunnel. She was being pulled down it so fast, but all her worries were gone. She was not in pain, she was no longer concerned about holding her breath, and she wasn't afraid at all. She said she was just in awe of everything that was happening. She said she was almost like a ball of energy moving through this tunnel. She realized at that point that she was separate from her body. And realistically, she knew her body could not have gotten out of where it was trapped. And all of a sudden, Sandy's body had been pulled back up by the water on the other side of the boulder. She was below the rapid in a calm pool, but she wasn't moving. And Keith could see that her face was down in the water. And that was when he knew they were going from a rescue to a body recovery. They had to get from the rocks back into the current, which Keith said took precious time. And during that time, the current grabbed her body from the calm pool, and once again, the river began pulling her away from them. Sandy had no concerns about anything at all. It was only peace, unlike anything she had ever felt before. And the next thing she knew, she went from being in the darkness to being in the light of day again. She wasn't back in her body, though. She was now floating above a woman's body, looking down at it. Initially, she didn't say it was her, she just said it was a woman. She could see the water rushing in and out of this body's mouth, and she could see her arms dangling down like a rag doll. And eventually, it dawned on her that this wasn't just a girl, this was her. Not only did Sandy say she could see her body in the water, but she could see the panic of everyone else who was trying to get to her. But she didn't feel any concern for herself. She was, however, concerned for the people in the raft, because they looked very scared and shocked. She knew without a doubt that she was dead. Keith and the other guides had to pursue this body being carried by the water, probably another football field's distance down the river. Keith said he felt the greatest sense of loss and failure. He knew he had to retrieve her, but his heart was broken. 90% of drowning victims are never revived, and even if they are revived, 1/3 of drowning survivors sustain permanent neurological damage. She had been dead for over 4 minutes, and her body was completely lifeless. Brain death occurs after 5 minutes without oxygen. So finally, Keith got next to Sandy's lifeless body, and he reached over into the water, grabbed a hold of her life jacket, and pulled her into the raft. Meanwhile, Sandy said she was watching Keith pull her body into the raft from above. And she thought that Keith was so kind and in control, and she had already known that he was a paramedic from talking to him earlier in the trip. She remembered thinking in that moment how lucky she was that the guide that had pulled her out of the water was also a paramedic. Isn't that so interesting? She's out of body, looking down and thinking, how lucky is that, that he's a paramedic?
Yeah, I mean, the fact that she's having any lucid thoughts at all is insane.
Right.
She's like watching what's happening.
So with one big pull, Keith pulled her body into the raft, and it was a large raft, and her body hit the floor of the raft pretty hard. Immediately upon hitting this hard floor, the impact had forced the water from her lungs, and she began coughing.
Wait, so he pulled her in.
And threw her onto the floor.
Threw her onto the floor, and she just woke up?
And she, yes, woke up, started coughing. For Sandy, it was as if someone had flipped a switch. She was just back in her body. She went from being above her body to now being back in her body. There was no travel time or tunnel. It was just immediate. So she took a huge gasp of air and was coughing, of course. She looked around at everyone staring at her and thought to herself that she was fine now, but she also was extremely panicked because she couldn't catch her breath. Keith was ecstatic. He said he doesn't have the words for the emotion he was feeling, but she was alive and it was amazing. Keith said when he looked in her eyes, something looked different. Something that he hadn't seen in another person before. Although Sandy was alive, there was...
Wait, what? Like, what was different?
I don't know, but he said she had a different look to her. I mean, she did just...
He didn't say anything else?
For about 5 minutes, but no, he didn't.
Nobody dug in there? I mean, like, what do you mean? What do you mean, dude?
I don't know. Maybe a sort of twinkle?
I don't know. Like, yeah, that's what I want to know. Like, what looked different?
I don't know.
Like, yeah, dude, she just died. She right. looks a little different.
Although Sandy was alive, there was no guarantee that she would be okay. They needed to get her to a hospital, but they were out in the middle of nowhere. There was no help out there for Sandy, and there was no calling 911. Sandy wasn't making eye contact with many people, which was unusual for her, but she was in shock. Keith and the other guides were very concerned for her and offered to bring in a helicopter to bring her out. And that was when Sandy started to fall apart, and she cried as hard as she could. She didn't want to ruin the trip for anyone else.
Sandy, call the chopper.
She declined a helicopter and completed the rest of the trip.
Are you insane?
Nope. She's just Sandy. I don't know.
Sandy. Sandy, you get somebody on the chopper.
Mm-mm.
You're going to the hospital, honey. Like, she what's didn't. Going on?
She didn't.
She was just fine.
Yeah. Sandy only suffered bruising on her body and no neurological injury.
This is a miracle. I mean... What do you mean? You just plopped her on the ground like a fish. She just came back to life.
Yeah.
She just, what?
Pretty much, yeah.
Threw up her, it's not even like threw up, just like the water exited her lungs.
Mm-hmm. And then she was back.
And then she was back.
Yeah, she was
like,
no
you know,
longer.
I don't want to put you guys out.
Yeah, that's quite literally
that's
exactly.
literally what she said.
Yeah.
It's like, She's I just like, no. died.
Yeah, I just died, but I don't want that to ruin anyone's trip, so.
I mean, I don't want to be a bummer. You know what I mean? I just watch my children like slideshow when they're 20. Don't mind me.
Oh,
I
don't
just had
mind
a very,
me.
I just had an out of body experience.
I was just floating above my dead body for 20 minutes.
What do
but
you mean?
Don't even worry about me. I don't want to ruin the rest of our whitewater rafting trip. So,
wow.
Yeah, that is such a woman thing to do, I feel.
I know. And it's hilarious that this is the first thing that she'd done for herself in years.
I know. Just so people-pleasing and just worrying about everyone else's feelings. It's very selfless. It's also kind of funny.
It's hilarious. I mean, I would be like, yeah, no, this trip is over. The chopper's coming in.
Most people would do that. But yeah. Sandy is very kind and selfless. So.
I mean, I guess technically she didn't need it.
No, yeah, she
but
was
like,
fine.
I guess there was no way to know that at the moment.
That'd be a pretty expensive ambulance, you know, a helicopter.
Yeah, I mean, well.
No, I mean, you take it if you have you know? To, obviously, but yeah.
You want to pay 20 grand or you want to die?
Well,
you know what
sure.
I mean?
For her, it wasn't even about that. She was like, I don't want to be a bother. And she seemed fine. She was like, I feel fine. So I don't need it. I don't know.
How do you just go back to the trip? You know?
That is like, a question I don't know the answer to. Like, you know?
Imagine this. So like everyone thinks she's dead. Mm-hmm. The guy picks her out of the water, her lifeless ragdoll body.
Yep.
Slams her on the raft. She just throws up water and then comes back too. You're like, hey, we need to get you to a hospital. She's like, nah. Like, I don't want to do that. What is the first thing that anyone said after that?
I don't know.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, that is a very odd thing to have to like readjust to to.
You're like looking at her and then you go, well, it is a nice day, right? Like, what do you say?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to waste a day like this, I guess. Right. You know what I mean? Yeah, I don't know.
It's like the water. How's the water?
It's fine.
How's the water?
It's just in my lungs, but it's fine now. Don't worry about me. Sandy's strongest memory of the experience was the sepia slideshow or sepia slideshow version of her sons.
That was her favorite part?
Her most strong memory was the image of her sons.
But do you mean it was the same image?
Yeah, she said she kept seeing the same image, like going away and coming back and going away and coming back.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Now, when they did grow up, how close was it?
Right. So when she was talking about it in her interview, she was like, well, my sons are now about to be in their 20s. And I just hope that I never see that picture. Because if I ever see that picture, I don't know what I'll do. She's like, I don't know what the universe was trying to tell me or what it means. But if I ever see that picture, I will freak out. Like, I will lose my shit. And I'm like, yeah, I would too. Who wouldn't lose their shit if you saw the picture that you saw when you died in a glacial cave under the water for 5 minutes? Like,
yeah, and then a tunnel teleported as a ball of energy.
Right. And then you were just over your lifeless corpse for however long. I don't know. It's crazy.
Did she say how long it felt like, or was time just not a concept?
She didn't mention time, but she did say that she could see the people trying to get to her and their panic in their face. And then he pulled her body onto the boat and then she was back in her body. So it seems like it was about the same amount of time as everyone else had experienced.
I can't believe it.
I don't know.
Interesting.
I don't have the answers. I'm trying to interpret as best as I can for you.
I mean, there's no interpretation. I'm just curious about any of the other details of her experience. Because it's just so unbelievable.
I know. I would love to have a conversation with someone who has an experience like this.
Yeah, you know? I want to know if she ever saw that picture.
I don't know. I will never know, unfortunately. She reunited with her sons 3 days after the drowning at the airport because she came back from her trip. And she, a few months later, met a wonderful man who she is married to now. She married him a year later. And she said, it's important to cherish the people that you love and make sure they know you love them. And that was her parting message. But that is kind of the whole thing that I have for you today. It's such an interesting concept. And I would love to look into more of these. So if you enjoyed this episode, I would be happy to do another one because there are many stories out there for me to talk about and look at. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think this could be a new, like, listener story type of segments.
Yeah.
Or episodes. I was so interested in it. And, like, I guess, like, even the stories that you had on their face were kind of short. It's not like they had an out-of-body experience for hours or days.
No.
You know? It was just quick. I wonder if there is anyone who has had kind of a more extended experience.
I believe there are people who were clinically dead for longer periods of time. Like for these stories, it was pretty much like, oh, they were dead for anywhere between 4 to 5 minutes. But I believe there are stories of people who were dead for like a half an hour or something like that. Like, I don't know if their experience is that long because a couple of the different stories that I've looked into, people are like, oh, I had no concept of time, like you had mentioned earlier. But yeah, I don't know. It could be really interesting to look into and I'd be happy to do it. I'm glad you enjoyed talking about it because I enjoyed looking into it.
Yeah. I mean, I just wonder, even if they don't have a concept of time, if they just recollect more things about the experience.
Maybe.
You know?
I don't know.
They were like, oh, I was in this place. Or like, maybe you have multiple places or just like anything more than like, oh, I was above my body and then I came back as soon as I hit the floor.
I don't know.
you know, once the hand pumped the lifeblood into me, you know, I came back.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm so interested.
I am too. It is also comforting to think about if that is the case, you know? I don't know. I'm not like a religious person necessarily, but it is cool to think about the idea of like loved ones coming to like greet you, you know, and like take you wherever you're supposed to go. I don't know. But I mean, death is such an like not taboo topic, I guess, kind of like it's what so many people fear, myself included. I mean, for so long, I was just like terrified of the concept of death. But I don't know. This is kind of a cool thing to think about, if nothing else. We'll never know, right?
Yeah, like, I know.
We'll never know, but it is interesting to think about. And if it gives anyone any shred of comfort, then great.
Yeah, no, I think it's super comforting too, because number one, it seems like it's mostly positive. And then like the loved ones being a common theme is good. And you mentioned it being taboo. I mean, you could be as scientific as you want, but you have to admit that there are like limits to what you can know.
Definitely. I think so.
You know, and I mean, this will be the ultimate one. I don't think we'll really ever fully figure it out.
No.
I mean, everyone you mentioned who studies this just shrugs their shoulders.
A little bit. I mean, I would be interested to look into it more and have more information for you. I only could do so much research in this time period, but... yeah, many of them were saying that like, yeah, it just does not make medical sense for a lot of these experiences, but they're all very similar and have like the same components, at least like for the people who do experience NDEs. Not everyone does.
Did you ever come across this? Because I've heard like when you die, your brain will release, I think, DMT or some like hallucinogen. I had always thought like, oh, this is what contributes to these types of experiences. Because people who do psychedelics will have kind of similar components of these experiences.
Yeah, I definitely don't have any of that like written down to give you exact facts, but there was discussion around psychedelics and research into NDEs using psychedelics. Because like if they couldn't actually get a person who like had experienced clinical death, they were like, well, how can we mimic that? But yeah, I don't know. I would have to look into that. And maybe we can dive into that a little bit more on another episode about this. But yeah, psychedelics were definitely in the conversation of this whole thing and like how they're similar experiences. And it's just all very interesting to try to figure out how it's connected, if at all. I don't know. I am just a girl. I don't know. Right. But
it's also like dreams are similar too.
Yeah. There was other research that was done into people who experience really vivid dreams and like REMs and like reach a certain level of REM sleep and how they experience, how like more people who experience that experienced NDEs.
Interesting. I mean, but the component of NDEs where you said people have no brain function is really interesting, because then that suggests that whatever experience you're having in the dream isn't necessarily tied to what's going on in your brain.
Well, yeah, it is an interesting thought, because I mean, the NDEs are definitely not the same thing as being in REM, because you have no brain function.
Right.
So there's nothing to see on a scan or whatever, because nothing's happening in your brain. Like when you're dreaming, at least a certain part of your brain is like lit up and there's obviously function because you're a living, breathing person. But that isn't the case for the NDEs. So it is interesting that there is even some kind of correlation between the two. But again, I mean, this research is all very like, we don't fully get it. So I'll just tell you what we do know, but I don't actually know how this happens.
Wild. I mean, do you have any theories?
Do I have any theories? No.
No.
I have no idea.
I don't even want to pontificate.
I have no idea. I mean, I enjoy the conversation and I think it's comforting, and I don't know what to make of it, but I like hearing people who have a background in it talk about it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm so interested to hear what their theories are, because I mean, you have to have one. You have to have some. I mean, even if it's super woo-woo.
Sure.
Like you have to have something that you think it might be.
Yeah, I guess it just depends on the person for the theory, obviously. Like if the person is religious or not, or believes in any supernatural things, or also even if they're just purely scientific and like whatever, like what they would all be different theories, you know? So I have no idea. I think it's really cool though. And I did want to just say at the end here, because this is a topic about near death and how it could be potentially positive. And I didn't want to give anyone the wrong idea. I want everyone to remain on Earth. So if there's any sort of like suicidal ideation happening for anyone, I just encourage you to reach out to someone in your life and find support, because you are loved and we want to keep you here. So
yeah, that's never the answer. And there's definitely help to be had. This is not the way out.
The National Suicide Hotline is 988. And I will post a link in our show notes for the international numbers as well. So I just wanted to put that out there at the end, because, you know, I just didn't want to give someone the idea that it was like so much better to die, you know?
Like, yeah, because it's not.
Yeah, I don't think that that's necessarily the case at all. So anyway, I don't know. I didn't know how to throw that out there at the end, but I just wanted to make a point to say we love you guys and thank you for being here. But anyway, why don't we have a bit of a palate cleanser? And we can talk about something completely unrelated to the topic so that we can go back to our normal days. What is your good thing?
My good thing is that I am off heavy pain meds.
Oh, yeah.
From my surgery.
We didn't even mention you got surgery.
Yeah, quick life update. I had shoulder surgery last week for a labral tear repair.
Oh, I did mention it. It was my good thing last week that you were out of surgery and, like, well.
Oh, okay. Then you do know that? I've had a number of people come up to me and be like, oh, rotator cuff.
Yeah.
And I'm like, close, but
the sling is, I think, triggering to people. It's like a very specific kind of heavy duty sling. So people tend to say something about it if they know about it, but.
Right. It's like it holds your arm away from your body. And it's because I had the surgery because I kept dislocating my shoulder. And this position was super, I don't know. It made me really apprehensive because this is a similar position to in which it
would dislocate.
Yeah. So I don't know, that hasn't been great, but I mean, I was in a good amount of pain the second day, second and third day,
of course.
And
it was major surgery.
I know, but like even with all of the meds I was on, it was like not great. So I'm glad I'm past that. So
yeah.
I'm feeling a lot better. I feel like I can kind of like gently kind of move it on its own again. And that isn't painful. So it's a big difference even within a week, which is so crazy.
Huge difference a week has made.
Yeah.
Because it was a week ago today that you got the surgery. So yeah, great.
Yeah, super happy to be out of that. What's your good thing?
My good thing is just that Christmas is just around the corner and I'm finally done with my Christmas shopping. We have so many presents for people.
I know.
It seems like the list just keeps getting longer and longer, but
yeah, I mean, we've had packages on packages.
But that, I mean, tis the season, right? Like,
tis the season.
Pretty much everyone is experiencing the same thing. But I'm just relieved that my list is complete. And now I have all the things that I'm going to give to people. And I think that they're pretty good gifts. And I'm excited to make people happy.
Spread Christmas cheer.
Spread the Christmas cheer. Make my family happy and have a good time. So that is my good thing. We both hope that you have very happy holidays, whatever you celebrate. And thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this one. We certainly did. If you would like access to a bunch of bonus episodes and vote on stories you want to hear, like this topic, head over to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. If you or anyone has a story of survival or something crazy that's happened to you or an NDE that you'd like to share with us and possibly hear on an upcoming listeners episode, send it to notodaypodcast@gmail.com. We have an Instagram where we post all the pictures of all the stories we talk about, and you can find the link to our merch shop in the bio at nottoday_podcast. We have a TikTok that is nottodaypodcast and a Twitter that is nottodaypodcast, but the T on the podcast is a 3.
Because that makes sense.
And just keep breathing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you someone who watches every true crime documentary the day that it releases and then find yourself always wanting to know more, Googling the timelines, red flags, and then falling into the social media rabbit hole? Well, I'm here to do all of that for you, bringing the facts, theories, and details that no one else is covering on my hit true crime podcast, Serialistly with Annie Elise. Whether it's everything with the Idaho 4 case now that the documents are unsealed, or shocking cases you've never heard of, packed with love triangles, cults, and twists you won't see coming. With over 1 million downloads a week, I break it down for you just like your best friend would. Serialistly with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.